Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very pleased to have with me today a new guest to the show. She's Abby Livingston. She's congressional correspondent and co-author of the Best and Brightest Morning Newsletter for Puck News. Puck is a digital media company founded in 2021. It covers the four centers of power. All right, listeners, can you guess what they are? No, it's not the Quad Cities. Washington, D.C., Hollywood, Wall Street, and Silicon Valley. All right, that about covers it, I guess. She also writes for the beloved Almanac of American Politics, which I love. So, Abby, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're going to sort all this out for us. I mean, we're living in a time of politics where every day brings new drama. I mean, every day. And each side is saying that if the other wins, it's the end of the country as we know it. I want to start out today just with what's going on with Elon Musk and Doge, D-O-G-E, the Department of Government Efficiency. You've been writing about this recently. How much success is he having in rooting out government waste? And, you know, he's talked about cutting trillions, whatever. What will the amount be? And then we'll get to some of the chaos that's been created here in a minute.
Well, I think it's the operative word in your question is what is waste and what do you think it is? And so we've seen him with the metaphorical and sometimes image-wise literal chainsaw rip through the federal government. And we've Washington, D.C. at this point is a very beaten down town and everyone knows someone who's been laid off, but it's also obviously extended deep into the country. And so I don't think we actually know yet. And it seems like they move from department to department. And so, and it hasn't been the most transparent process. So we're still waiting to see. But there are costs to this. And I think that is what most of Washington and the political class is bracing for this, specifically with the Social Security Administration. And if we see disrupted payments to senior citizens.
Yeah, it's I mean, I'm hearing that on the ground level, people starting to get concerned about Social Security and should I retire now or should I wait? And will there be anybody to take my call? It sounds like it's had some impact at the local level to some degree in Social Security and other agencies. Is that what you're picking up as well?
We are seeing I've covered politics a long time, and the outrage right now that we are seeing on the ground via these town halls is possibly surpassing what we saw in August 2009 against Obamacare. And people are furious, and I think they're only going to grow more furious as these changes are lagging indicators from things that happened weeks ago. And so it's going to take a while for these to sort through. But, you know, we can see problems with the National Weather Service. It could go in very many different directions. And so there is something happening on the ground that is very interesting in American politics right now.
Yeah. And I've seen also threats to cut agencies that gather data and statistics. And it's like, where will we go for data to cover like the economic trends and population trends and things like that? Who knows if it's going to go down that far? Has Musk talked about going after the Defense Department at all at this point? A lot of people feel that's one of our biggest spending categories, and there's a lot of waste there as well.
Off the top of my head, I believe they've at least visited physically the Pentagon, but the Pentagon is the biggest place. This is where so much government spending happens. Mr. Musk has many business interests in this area. He's been very interested in the future of the F-35 fighter plane. You know, he is into aeronautics. Maybe he's wanting to get in on that business. But it's, you know, we've been watching from building to building, but they started at USAID, which doesn't directly touch that many Americans. But boy, the Pentagon sure does.
You know, it seems strange, but a lot of things are strange about our politics these days, that he's going after the fear out here is that, like, going after the U.S. Department of Agriculture programs that directly impact farmers, which was a major source of support for him. His promise seems to be just wait. It's going to be hard to get through this. But are Republicans on the Hill, do you think they're in line with a lot of these cuts and what's going on right now? Or are you starting to see cracks in the wall?
Republicans tend to be in line with cuts that don't apply to their districts.
Imagine that.
I say that a little facetiously, but I don't think that there is a more interesting political sector in America in 2025 right now than agricultural communities. And it's for several reasons. This was the first group to feel the impact domestically of what appears to be the abolition of USAID. You've got the tariffs issue. And some of your listeners may be familiar with something called the Farm Bill. That is in trouble. And that is the backbone of security for farmers. And so what I have heard, perhaps less from Republicans, but more from Democrats who represent rural areas, who know what they're talking about, not consultants in a room trying to like come up with language. These Democrats tell me that they think they are being heard, that rural America is listening to the Democratic Party in a way they haven't in a very, very long time.
That's interesting. We'll see how that plays out here. I mean, the tariff issue, I wanted to move to that next. I'm surprised. I was like many people. I guess I thought maybe this was just a bargaining position Trump was staking out with other countries. But it seems like he's moving forward with this. I mean, we're recording on Tuesday, so I mean, today's supposedly the day that he's going to implement a lot of these. Is this what you're picking up from your sources, that, yep, he's moving through and we're going to have short-term pain in the economy?
I think the consensus is that Donald Trump has not been that big on policy or that passionate about almost any policy except two things, the border and tariffs. And this is an interest that he has demonstrated going as far back as the 1980s. And so I think sort of the logic of whoever was last in his ear is most influential, that has applied to most Donald Trump policies. Close observers do not use that with tariffs, that he has a very strong position and we should assume things are going to happen. Now, he will walk them back. But I think right now everyone's bracing for this to happen. But again, whether or not it happens, there is already damage being done to the business community, as many, you know, producers and vendors are having a hard time figuring out how to even practice their business right now, because the rules are changing so quickly.
Yeah. Is there an underlying, I keep looking for it, I guess, to try to be fair and look at this on both sides, but an underlying meaning to the madness here? I mean, taking over Greenland, for example, Canada, how he's treating Canada. I mean, I read on the one hand, he's trying to firm up the Western Hemisphere and like go back to the isolationist days. On the other hand, you just don't know. I mean, it's like you said, maybe it's depends on the day and who talks to him last.
I think generally speaking, he should be taken literally. And it's because the guardrails that were up the last time during the first Trump administration are not there. He has a very different kind of staff that's less likely to push back against him. He knows he cannot be removed from office through impeachment, which is the last resort, because the Senate has twice refused to convict him at trial, one of which involved an insurrection that penetrated the Senate chamber. So there's nothing to stop him. So I think the rule of thumb should be to take him literally, but also he does change his mind on certain topics and be prepared for change.
It's amazing that he's been able to hold the Republicans in the Senate and the House together, Speaker Johnson in the House. I know the Republicans have 53 seats in the Senate, and I can't recall. I know there's some specials tonight with a razor thin margin in the House, correct?
This is how I would describe what happened in November. It was, for Democrats, a political catastrophe, and Republicans have gotten power unlike they've had in decades. But when you talk about the politics of it, this was a very close election at the Senate level, at the presidential and the House, no more closer than in the House. And this margin is extremely dysfunctional. It creates many, many problems within the House Republican conference. And astonishingly, there are two safe Republican seats up to replace people that Trump picked out of the House for his cabinet. And one of them may be in play, and it is unfathomable. If this seat flipped, which most political observers don't think it will, but it should be, it's going to be much closer than expected. But if it flipped, it would be as shocking as when Scott Brown, the Republican, won the Massachusetts Senate seat in 2010. Like, it would be a big deal.
I remember that. And one of his cabinet appointees was taken from the House is kind of on hold up in New York. Can you explain that a little bit, what's going on and why now the kind of the caution?
So there were three open seats in the House that were going to happen this spring. So the two in Florida that were Republican held, and then one in upstate New York held by a very up and coming Republican young woman named Elise Stefanik. Stefanik, right after the election, got one of the first cabinet appointments to the United Nations. And people were shocked at the time Trump did it because the House margin was looking so tight that that was going to make the House more difficult. And it did. But she went through the confirmation process, but they never actually confirmed her. So they've kept her in the House for a long time because they don't have room to lose any votes when they pass these big tax cut bills. And so finally, they just said, Congresswoman Stefanik, we need you to stay in the party and we need you to withdraw from the United Nations ambassadorship. And so she, and basically it was a tell that they are very, very worried about the political environment. And her upstate New York seat is Republican, but it has a history of voting Democratic, and it could have gotten very scary for Republicans. And so it appears that race is no longer happening, and it's a real tell of weakness right now for Republicans.
Are relationships on the Hill, where you report and specialize, are they that fractured between the parties, or are there places where they are communicating at least the possibility of, and I know it sounds crazy, but getting along and maybe cooperating on some types of issues that come before them, which is what the American people deep down, I think a lot of people in the middle want.
But the people they hear from do not. And that's the problem. And so it is as toxic as it's ever been on Capitol Hill. I think there is a line of demarcation before and after the insurrection in how the two parties relate to each other. But we have seen today some troublemakers with against House leadership. Two young women, Republican Anna Paulina Luna from Florida and Democrat Brittany Patterson, teamed up and basically are moving through a rule change that will allow new and expectant parents to vote by proxy, so they can vote from afar if they're in labor. And so House leadership has pushed against it, but they've managed to team up with enough Republicans to really, it's an interesting bipartisan effort that we have not seen the likes of in a long time.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. Talking politics today in Washington with Abby Livingston, who's a congressional correspondent for Puck News. Puck is a digital company, if you haven't heard of it, founded in 2021. A lot of really, really good writers are there, including Abby. And I suggest you check it out. She also is a co-author of the Best and Brightest Morning Newsletter. Abby is an award-winning reporter, an expert on campaigns in Congress. She previously worked at CNN, NBC, the National Journal, Roll Call, and the Texas Tribune. And I hope we get time to talk Texas politics here a little later. Of course, the interplay between governing and politics. A lot of Democrats are still upset at Chuck Schumer, Dick Durbin from here in Illinois, for voting for the budget compromise. It just seems like is what you described in a recent column as an identity crisis in the Democratic Party. And how can they effectively respond to what's going on when they're not in power? In the Senate, they do have the possibility of needing 60 votes to cut off debate, all that. But other than that, they're not in power. How are they best to try to respond to what's going on?
Well, we're seeing an example of it as we record this in Senator Cory Booker is doing an old-fashioned filibuster, a real-life filibuster where it takes physical stamina and the ability to talk for hours and hours at length. And he's giving the Senate filibuster record held by Strom Thurmond, of all people, a real run for its money. And so I think the Schumer fight was extremely painful for Democrats, and it was not a fight that people close to it enjoyed. What I can say is that with this filibuster, with the town halls, with the outrage over the Signal chat leaking, Democrats have much more pep in their step than they would have expected 2 weeks ago, is what folks told me today. And so it's a really interesting moment where they're starting to feel the political winds change, but they are still very, very much out of power and very limited in what they can do.
Yeah, it seems like the folks protesting the most want them to do something, but it's like, what can you do when you don't have power? I did see today, and Puck reported it, and I saw in the Wall Street Journal that attorneys general from across the country, Democrats, are trying to take measures in the courts to head this off. But other than that, and the filibuster power, that seems about it for the Democrats to fight back.
It's being in the minority is both completely frustrating and also a lot of fun. It's frustrating because you have so little power and people will yell things like you need to have hearings with that person and you don't have the power to subpoena anyone. You don't have this. You don't even get to set the agenda. But on the other hand, you're not responsible for counting votes beyond making sure stuff you don't like gets passed. And so you're the onus of governing is not on you as much as it is the majority. And so Democrats right now basically have to figure out their bully pulpit, what it looks like, how they're going to communicate. And, you know, having an old fashioned Senate filibuster seems to be a very interesting tact of late and a very new direction for the Senate Democrats.
Yeah, I saw James Carville, who I had on my show a couple of years ago, the noted Democratic consultant under Clinton, advised the Democrats just to lay low and kind of wait, adopt a very conservative strategy and wait till things get messed up enough, which they hope will happen. It don't know. It seems like both strategies are in place to some degree, and that, you know, if there are perceived mistakes made, cuts in vital programs, tariffs increase the cost of trucks, maybe they're doing both strategies at once here.
I actually had that thought today when I was talking to a Senate Democratic source that, and that Carville op-ed was extremely controversial in Democratic circles. I think even he has said that they're at a point where it's already gotten to the point that he was expecting it to. And so, I think there's a lot of throwing spaghetti on the wall, and every once in a while, something actually does stick.
The interesting thing and the challenge is, though, that in my discussions with people and my observation, and I'll see what you think, is we've got such the hyper partisanship, but also negative partisanship, where each side just hates the other, unlike what I've ever seen in all my years in politics. It's almost like Republicans who start maybe to object to Trump out here in the heartland, the people I talk to. We hate these tariffs. They're going to hurt ag. They're going to raise the cost of our trucks. But when they look at the face of the Democratic Party, there's no way they're going that way. And that creates the problem here again with the Democrats' identity problem. Do they kind of shift to the middle, or are they going to keep going in more of a progressive way? Do you have any reaction to that?
Well, I think it's a delayed argument until the 2028 cycle, which will really begin right after the midterms. So I think between now and November 2026, we're going to see a lot of this litigated. We're going to see it litigated in congressional and Senate and gubernatorial primaries. We're going to see how strong the party is at getting their preferred candidates through these primaries. And I think, you know, I think the farm team that comes up in 2026 will be very telling in what cues presidential candidates will take. I think this is a long fight the Democrats have to litigate, but there are counter arguments that the party didn't go progressive enough and that too many people stayed home. And so this is a very active fight. And I think that the midterms are kind of like the preseason spring training of figuring out those questions.
Who do you see? Do you see some rising stars coming up, younger people? Because one of the big things, too, I hear about is the Democratic Party leadership is so old. Schumer, and no disrespect to elderly, but I mean, they are mostly older. Pelosi was, Schumer. Nobody really knows the Democratic leader in the House. Are there some up and comers in Congress that you think we should take a look at and keep our eye on?
The Democratic Party is stacked with talent, and it comes back to the year 2018 when all of these people running ran for office, whether they won a statewide seat like Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan or ran for the U.S. House or the state legislature. And we are seeing those candidates come into maturity. And that's part of why there's been so much anger at Joe Biden, was that it wasn't like there wasn't anyone who could run. And so it's absolutely yes. But the way Congress works and the Democratic Party specifically is there is so much deference to seniority and tenure and people who have put in the years and been loyal to the party. But what I can say is, even though it doesn't look like it to the outside world, we are watching a revolution on the Hill when it comes to age. And a case in point was we saw several of the top Democrats on committees basically push out very aging members. And there seems to be an understanding that, you know, one member at 80 years old might not be at the top of their game anymore, but there's another one who is. And so it's not a, you know, get rid of everyone. But I think many older Democrats, if you're over the age of 75, I've written this, and your name is not Nancy Pelosi, Rosa DeLauro, who's the ranking member of the Appropriations Committee, and Marcy Kaptur, who's an Ohio congresswoman with tough races, you're probably going to get a challenge this year. And so it's, we just have not seen very many incumbents lose re-election, and it's going to be a very interesting midterm.
That's, I think you're right. I saw you wrote a piece on the 28 race already and the consultant, Democratic consultants. And I can tell you from experience and also people I talk to, they are really perceived as part of the problem. With some of their approaches to campaigns, especially out here in the heartland. But what's going on with them circling around kind of some of the possible candidates in 28? What did you find in your research and reporting on that?
So there's several consultants who have candidates who are have multiple potential presidential candidates in 2028. And so we're going to see some of these firms either give up their clients and their clients go find new consultants and vendors, or they start creating legal firewalls. But, you know, I counted, and not all of them are going to run, but I counted about 24 Democrats who I believed could run a viable presidential campaign. They weren't kind of randos who wander onto the debate stage. And, you know, most of the, not all of them are going to run, but I think there's going to be a real changing of the guard at the consultant level, too. It's been the same usual suspects running presidential campaigns. And I think we're going to, you know, the technology has changed. When I started this stuff, the only things that really mattered were, you know, polling, TV commercials, and direct mail. And now digital is such a dominant part of the campaign. And so I think it's just going to be the 2028 campaign on both sides of the aisle is going to look completely different from anything we've ever seen, both because of the political environment and just the evolution of technology.
Boy, that's interesting. And I have to ask, too, I know the Republican Party seems more, of course, now there's talk of Trump running for a third term, which would appear to be unconstitutional, but you know, his successor obviously would be J.D. Vance, maybe even his son. But I have to ask too: do you see other up and coming Republicans who, over the horizon, if the Trump effect breaks at some point, that might be there as viable candidates?
Yes, and I think that we've seen, it's hard to realize this, but Trump has been blocked out the sun for Republicans at almost in every campaign since 2016. So we've seen an entire generation. I'm from Texas. I think Ted Cruz will probably run again, but he's actually kind of old news by 2028. I think Josh Hawley has long wanted to run. I keep an eye on Chris Sununu. But so there have been folks waiting in the wings, but I mean, their modus operandi is to defer to him.
I want to bring up one name back on the Democratic side, who's you know, a favorite target of Republicans, but she seems to be going through a transformation. That's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, as she's known by. You know, she was elected under remarkable circumstances, really, if people take the time to fairly look at it, in defeating a longtime incumbent in Congress. But she's kind of was associated with the squad on the far left, but she seems to be kind of positioning herself different now.
So she didn't just knock off a longtime congressman. She knocked off one of the most popular congressmen. Everybody loved Joe Crowley. So anytime that happens, it's always a rough start. But to exacerbate things, she was a 28-year-old kid. And, she came in very headstrong. She antagonized Nancy Pelosi, which is a big no-no, and really upset some of her colleagues and rallied against them. She didn't endorse against them in too many primaries, but she made everyone nervous. And we have seen a total transformation in the last few years. And she was constantly running from the outside against the party. And she is becoming one of the biggest donors to colleagues, helping vulnerable Democrats who may not see the things the same way she does. She funds their campaigns. She's become a real team player within the party. And so we are seeing her master the outside game early in her career, and she's starting to learn the inside game as well. So I think she's going to be a fascinating member to watch if she decides to stay in the House.
I've got about 1 minute left, and I wanted to get back to Texas politics, where you're from, and here we go. I've been following Texas politics for a long time. I think some of our politically in tune listeners are, and we keep waiting. People keep saying it's going to change, demographics are going to change it into a Democratic state. It hasn't happened. Why hasn't it? And what's it going to take for the state to change? It seems like the Latino vote, which was mostly Democratic, is kind of moving back to the middle now. What's your analysis down there?
I think Texas is just a conservative state. That is just how it votes. And it's gotten stronger for Republicans. That said, if you get a strong candidate and a weak Republican statewide candidate and a good political climate for Democrats, I think Texas is in play. But it sometimes the factors are beyond Democrats' control to make it a good race.
Thank you so much for being with me today on Heartland Politics, Abby. Abby Livingston's been my guest today. She's the congressional correspondent for Puck News, and she's co-author of The Best and Brightest, a morning newsletter. She's done some great work in reporting and analyzing what's going on in our politics. It's an incredible time, and we depend on good journalists like Abby to keep us informed. And you've heard her today talk about what's going on. It's an important time in our country's history, and I think we're on the cusp of something really big, as she's talked about here in the next several years. Abby, thank you so much for being my guest today on Heartland Politics.
Thanks for having me.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.